Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been 3 months since protests began in Ukraine following President Viktor Yanukovych's refusal to sign a trade deal with the European Union. He turned toward Moscow instead. This week has seen the deadliest clashes yet between protesters and security forces in the country's capital, Kiev. As EU foreign ministers meet to discuss possible sanctions, lethal violence has been spreading to the rest of the country, and the death toll continues to rise. This hour, On Point, we look deep into the political crisis in Ukraine, threatening to ensnare Russia, Europe, and the United States. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is the situation in Ukraine now spinning out of control? What's at stake here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look at the continuing anti-government protests in Venezuela. But first, to Kiev. Here's sound from Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, earlier this week. Anti-government protesters tried to chase police officers who responded with stun grenades and tear gas. And here at a central Kiev hospital yesterday, one protester from western Ukraine telling the BBC that riot police had beaten him unconscious.
We fight for Ukraine, for freedom. And we would like to see ours, Ukraine, like independent country. You know, this dictator, they have no rules.
Joining me now from Ukraine's capital, Kiev, is Sabra Ayers, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Sabra, welcome to On Point. Where are you in the city at this point, and what have you seen today, Sabra?
Hi. Well, I am about three blocks up the hill from the main square there, the Maidan. And today, actually this morning, I have to admit that I was woken up by the fighting that happened after the day before when, as you know, Tuesday was quite a long day of violence. And I slept a little bit late this morning and woke up to hearing this firefight. I later went down to the square when it had calmed down a little bit, and there's still lots of protesters down there. Very tense scene. It's about as bad as I've ever seen the situation in Ukraine. And when I was standing on Maidan near a McDonald's, I actually saw a woman who had just been hit by a sniper. I don't know if you've been following on Twitter, but there was a young 21-year-old medical volunteer who was hit by a sniper, and I saw her walking towards the. She actually walked to the ambulance, which immediately. Then took her for care. I've heard that she later died, but it's extremely tense right now in the streets.
The death toll is high and presumably will keep changing. The latest we had heard was 26 before the quote-unquote truce, and 20-plus since that truce. We're into scores at this point. And we're also hearing that the protesters now have a lot of police in their, I don't know what the right word is, custody.
They did take this morning when they kind of pushed their they tried to gain more territory back on the Maidan and kind of oddly the police initially fell back, meaning they gave them some of that ground and then came back in, and that's when I think the shooting happened. And they did get some of the police. I myself didn't see them, so I can't confirm that. I've seen reports of it, and I did hear the speaker in Maidan. Oddly, this is a kind of a revolution with a speaker and a stage. and I did hear him saying, "Don't touch them, don't hurt them," and that sort of thing. So, but I myself did not see those police officers, which they had, sort of captured. I think, from what I'm hearing, they were being kept in an area behind. The stage, but I don't know that for sure.
Sabra, you used the word revolution. What do the protesters want?
Well, you know, undoubtedly, what they're saying is they want Yanukovych, the President Yanukovych, to step down. They accuse him of corruption. They accuse him of creating a sort of power vertical in which he has now has so much control over the country politically and economically that they just have there's just no opportunity for them to grow as a country. They feel, especially the younger Ukrainians, who feel that his pure monopoly over power and the economy has left them in a situation where opportunities don't exist for them, and that sort of thing. There is obviously a large element here between this tug of war, which Ukraine has always been in the middle, with the West trying to drive a wedge between Russia and Ukraine to try to get Ukraine into the Western fold, and Russia fighting that. That element obviously is huge in this situation, but Ukrainians, when you talk to them that are on the ground, on the square, they will tell you, we don't want to live in a dictatorship. We want a country where we get to, live in a democracy, and we want opportunities, and we want rule of law, and we want, human rights. We want a government that respects us as citizens, and we're tired of this corruption. So that's what that's what they'll tell you on the ground, and obviously there's a lot of geopolitics behind it.
Sabra, last question, and our time is short at this point, but what, from your conversations, what do protesters appear to expect from Russia in this crisis standoff, and what do they appear to want from Europe, the U.S.?
Well, that's a complicated question, because when you ask the people, obviously, that are on the square, their answer is going to be a lot different than what you're going to hear from people who are in different parts of Ukraine. There is really a battle going on between different mentalities here. There's a kind of a Soviet hangover mentality of a lot of the older generations and a lot of the Ukrainians who still live in the industrial East and South, where they depend on state-run and state-subsidized industries, and they want to be kind of in that Russian fold, where they see a powerful president such as Vladimir Putin, and that they want that stability, is what they say. And then when you talk to Ukrainians who are in part of this sort of pro-European movement, or pro independent Ukraine movement, because it's not necessarily all of them want to immediately join the EU. That's not necessarily the case. They will tell you a little bit of a different story. So it's there has been some disappointment that I've heard voiced from Ukrainians on the square about they felt that the West had abandoned them and maybe given them a lot of moral support, but a lot of them will say, yeah, we need more than moral support.
Sabra Ayres with the Christian Science Monitor in Kyiv, in a fiery, violent Kyiv over these days. Thank you very much for being with us for a few minutes, Sabra.
Sure.
Everybody looking on now, Moscow maybe most of all, but Europe and the U.S. have all been actors here. This was back in December, protests already on. This was U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland in the streets of Kyiv in the Maidan, handing out bread to protesters.
Good to see you. We're here from America. Would you like some bread? Please take something. Take something. Guys, are you hungry? No? Take some stuff.
Geopolitics and a handful of bread. Joining me now from Vienna is Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale, a close observer of Russia, Ukraine, Europe, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Timothy Snyder, thank you very much for joining us.
Very glad to do it.
What's going on here?
Easy question you ask. Well, at the international level, what's going on is an encounter of two very different political logics. At the international level, you have two large international organizations, each of which are at the edge of Ukraine. On the one side, you have the European Union, which is a voluntary group of more or less but generally prosperous democracies. It's decentralized, bureaucratic, very confusing. It's attractive to people on its borders, but it has no foreign policy generally as such. On the other side, you have something called the Eurasian Union, which at this point is the sort of dream empire of Vladimir Putin. It doesn't exist yet except as a kind of notion of how Russian empire might be restored. It is not democratic. It's hierarchical. It can't include liberal democratic states, because if it did, that would threaten Putin's methods and model of control in Russia. So at the international level, what's happening is that many Ukrainians, as your correspondent said, would like to move in the direction of the European Union. The European Union is just there. It's a kind of attractive force. Whereas in Moscow, Russia wants to have a Eurasian Union which will include Ukraine. For the Eurasian Union to include Ukraine, it has to be a dictatorship. For Ukraine to be a dictatorship, the Maidan, all opposition, in fact, of any form, any politics, has to be crushed, which is more or less what we're seeing now. At the domestic level, things are very different. At the domestic level, the basic issue from the point of view of most Ukrainians who are resisting is decency, normality, predictability, what we might call the rule of law and human rights. The possibility of having your children go to good schools, of your having reasonable jobs, of not having to bribe the tax inspector, of everyone not being corrupt. Those are the basic issues that Ukrainians who are opposing the regime associate with Europe. That's what Europe means to them.
And with Russia right next door, just in the last few hours, Timothy, we've heard this framed in this way. If Ukraine goes, Putin's Russia goes. His whole structure of rule goes, or at least he fears that. Does that sound credible?
Well, I mean, first one has to reframe the question. What does it mean if Ukraine goes?
If
Ukraine has been an independent state for more than 20 years, the problem is that Russia and Putin in particular is politically, and I would even say emotionally, overcommitted to Ukraine. Once you get your own confidence and power in your own country caught up with how well you can control events in a different country, then you've got a problem. Then you can overreach. It's certainly true that democracy in Ukraine is a risk for Russia, but I think that's a problem which has to do with the way politics is organized inside Russia itself.
I'm Tom Asprick. This is On Point. Medical workers there treating injured protesters after clashes yesterday in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. We're talking about the crisis in Ukraine this hour for Ukraine, for Russia, for the rest of the world. Here was Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych speaking yesterday morning about how to end the crisis, he said, in his country, interpreted here by the BBC.
I call upon the leaders of the opposition one more time, who claim to be seeking a peaceful solution to the crisis. Separate yourself from radical elements who seek bloodshed and conflict with law enforcement agencies. Or in the case that they do not wish to separate themselves, they must admit that they are supporting radicals. Then there will be a different conversation with them. I will be honest. I have aides who are trying to convince me to take harsher measures, to resort to force, but I have always considered the use of force a mistake.
Ukrainian President Yanukovych yesterday, protesters want him out of office. They want a more democratic system instated in Ukraine. Timothy Snyder joins us today from Vienna, professor of history at Yale. He's followed all of this very closely. With us right now as well from Washington, D.C. is Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, now director of the Brookings Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative. Stephen Pfeiffer, Ambassador Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We're going to look more at the domestic piece, but the international piece has everyone's attention lately. We heard something out of the Crimea, Russian-speaking Crimea, saying maybe we need help from outside, or that was implied. Is this taking us back to some kind of Cold War dynamic? Do you have the Russian invasion of Hungary, 1950, what was it, 9, on your mind as we look at this, Ambassador Pfeiffer, or not?
No, I think the Russians have lots of tools to try to influence what's going on in Ukraine, but actual military force is way at the bottom of that list. That opens up a can of worms that I think the Russians would prefer to avoid. But you are seeing something of a geopolitical struggle, but it's an uneven fight. For Russia, having Ukraine in its sphere of influence is very important to Vladimir Putin's self-image of Moscow as a superpower. It's important to him in domestic political terms. So he sees this very much as a zero-sum game. Europe looks at it differently. It's not a geopolitical battle for Europe in those terms. Had it been so, Europe 2 years ago would have signed the association agreement that was at the root cause of the first demonstrations back in November. Mm-hmm. The Europeans didn't. Instead, they told the Ukrainians, you need to make progress on strengthening your democratic norms before we'll go forward with that signature. So there's a bit of a struggle here, but it's very much an uneven one.
Timothy Snyder, does that mean that the Ukrainian protests are doomed if Moscow's right next door and has a bigger, deeper, more urgent interest? EU has an element of ambivalence. Are they going nowhere?
Well, the difference, I think, is that because of the different nature of their political systems means that Russia can apply power very quickly. It can act politically in a very nimble way. It can throw money around. It can change its mind from day to day, as we see. The European Union moves very slowly. So Russia has a dynamic foreign policy, but it doesn't really lead anywhere. It's mainly about questions of self-image and domestic politics. The European Union is very slow. It's tortoise-like. But insofar as it has a foreign policy, it leads somewhere interesting, which is towards the rule of law, towards trade with the largest market in the world, and eventually towards membership in the European Union. So if you can get over the hump, and I admit that's a very big if, there's something waiting for you on the other side. But what the West would have to do, and this is the big question mark, is get behind financially and politically a whole series of steps which would allow us to get beyond the violence of the streets towards the constitutional reforms that are being discussed in your Ukrainian parliament right now as we speak, towards a transitional government after elections, and towards a whole series of reforms that would make the state function better. We would have to pay more attention than we have been paying, and we'd be willing to pay more money than we have been paying. It would have to become more important to us.
But if these two powers are working on different cycles, Russia's is much closer, bigger, and more urgent. I mean, these protests can't last forever, presumably. So how does this play out if the EU's on a slow cycle, Russia's on a fast and right-next-door cycle?
Well, I think when you look outside, I mean, the United States, the European Union, and the Russians can have some impact. But this, to me, is still a crisis that's first and foremost going to be resolved by Ukrainians. And I think Timothy made a very important point earlier, is that for the demonstrators out there on the streets, it's not just about drawing closer to Europe, but it's getting the rule of law, the normalcy that you see in Europe. It's a pushback against the growing corruption that they've seen during the 4 years of Yanukovych's tenure. It's a pushback against the growing authoritarian trend. And Europe is attractive in that sense. When they look east towards Russia, Russia has nothing to compete with that. So this is a struggle first, I think, that's going on within Ukraine. And I would guess that even in eastern Ukraine, where the sentiment may not be so strongly pro-European, you've seen growing frustration in the last 4 years of the growing frustration with the growing corruption and with some of the authoritarian trends of Yanukovych.
I'm trying to get a sense of how hard the U.S. is behind the scenes working on this. Of course, there was that private conversation between Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and your successor in Kiev, Ambassador Pfeiffer, the current U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt. This was leaked onto YouTube earlier in February, presumably, many people are presuming, by Russians. Ambassador Pyatt saying that Russia would be working to shut down any deal between the Ukraine and the West. Here it is. There's a bit.
We've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
Ambassador Pfeiffer, there's been a lot of talk out of Moscow that this is, you know, foreign fomentation of trouble in their good friend Ukraine.
No, I think what the focus of the American effort and of the Europeans has been to try to press very hard to get Yanukovych and the political opposition to sit down and try to get some kind of a dialogue underway that can see its way to a peaceful settlement of the crisis. That's going to be really, really hard to do. First of all, Yanukovych by temperament is not someone that gives you confidence that he would be prepared to make those concessions necessary to at least some of the opposition demands to get the dialogue going. And the opposition, while the three main opposition leaders that have been meeting with him have hung together fairly well, it's not clear that they speak for the demonstrators, who I think in the last several days have become increasingly radicalized. So that's a very hard process to encourage. But when you talk to people in the U.S. government, they say, if you don't have that process, what's the alternative? The alternative is what you see taking place on the streets of Kiev today, which is not a pretty sight. It's going to get a lot of people killed.
We just have the latest in here from CNN. At this point, the protesters' medical service, Timothy Snyder, now saying that 100 people have died in fighting on Thursday, 500 injured. And, of course, there were nearly two dozen or more in the days before that. How do you see this simmering down? Or is there a path? Do you see forces, heavier forces coming in from the Ukrainian government, Timothy? What dynamic could settle this or move it out of this bloody deadlock?
Stephen is absolutely right that the only way to change this course is for some kind of political process to get traction. What's happening now is horrible and absolutely intolerable under any notion of human rights or international law or the norms of how police are supposed to be able to behave. But what began, the way it began this morning, was by the police feinting a withdrawal from the Maidan, and then when people followed them up the street, opening fire with live ammunition, beginning the killing. And then over the course of the day, people have been sniping, almost certainly special police units have been sniping, again using live ammunition, aiming for heads and chests, killing women and men, killing people who are not fighting, who are simply walking on the street. Naturally, when one side is using live ammunition and is perched and sniping, and the other side is not and is behind wooden shields or nothing at all, you're going to have a very high death toll. This is absolutely intolerable. This goes beyond anything like police brutality, a term that we like to use in the West. The first thing that has to happen is that has to stop. And then we have to have the traction of a political process in which some members of the governing party, the party of regions, have to find a way to talk to the parties that are in the opposition. There are good signs that something like that could actually happen. If that begins, then the extremists on both sides, and there are hardliners in the government who want to use force and who are a threat to Yanukovych himself, and there are irresponsible people in the opposition who want to use force. If the moderates on both sides can find a way to begin a conversation, you can marginalize the people who want to move violence and move forward with constitutional reform, perhaps fresh elections, some kind of transition government. But that has to happen in Parliament. That's the crucial thing. This has to be a political solution. And I think the Americans and the Europeans are both behaving very responsibly in seeking to do the things they can to make that kind of political process more likely to start. That's what they're doing.
Ambassador Pfeiffer, what do you see as the odds of that happening in Ukraine's parliament with all of this mayhem going on? And if it doesn't happen, if there is no political solution, Timothy Snyder calls this absolutely intolerable, this huge death toll, aren't at this point the EU and the United States tolerating it?
Well, I think Timothy's right. There has to be a political dialogue. The Ukrainian parliament would be a good place to start. Unfortunately, from what I saw this morning, is the parliament did not meet as it was scheduled to do. Only the opposition parties showed up. So it's not clear that that dialogue is taking place there. And what is going on is something that I would have expected to see in Ukraine. I think Ukrainians generally have taken pride in the past that they resolved their political differences peacefully. The 2004 Orange Revolution was virtually bloodless. And it's got to be distressing to many Ukrainians. And there actually may be a backlash against President Yanukovych over this heavy-handed use of force that you've seen and this brutal use of force in the last couple of days. Now, unfortunately, it's hard for the United States and the European Union because the tools are limited. You're not going to see the 82nd Airborne parachute into Kyiv to solve this. But there are some tools that Washington began to apply yesterday. The department has basically banned visas for 20 Ukrainian officials who are connected with the use of force. European Union leaders are supposed to meet today, and there's talk that they will also adopt similar sanctions. And I think it's useful for the U.S. and the EU to signal that those connected to use of force are going to be sanctioned. I would actually hope to see them take an additional step, and that is to begin to apply or threaten visa and financial sanctions, not just against those connected with use of force, but those in the Yanukovych inner circle, some of the oligarchs who have supported them, and try to pressure those guys to say either you need to separate from Yanukovych or you need to be pushing him to take a different course. And you can hold at risk a number of these guys. They have apartments. They have houses in Vienna, London. They put a lot of their money in Western institutions because they don't trust Ukrainian banks. If all of a sudden they begin to see their ability to travel in the West, to do business and banking in the West at risk, they might begin to pressure Yanukovych in a way that could change the game. So I think there are still tools that the EU and the United States have, and I hope they move to apply them very quickly.
It would be great if tools can be found. But I have to say, Timothy Snyder, I still don't see the way out. The fundamental thing here Yanukovych moved away from the trade deal with the European Union. He moved toward an economic, deeper economic embrace, even rescue by Moscow. Putin wants that. I mean, can Ukraine stay in Russia's economic embrace, which Vladimir Putin seems to require, and have the kind of political evolution that the protesters want, Timothy?
If we take a step back and just look at the economics, Ukraine and Russia have basically the same economic interests. They both should be trading with the European Union. It's the largest trade partner for both of them, and it's the largest trade group in the entire world, in the history of the world, for that matter. They should. That's where both of their economic interests lead. Putin's Eurasian Union is not an economic idea. It's a political idea. I mean, cutting Russia and Ukraine off from the European Union is a political idea, which is going to have negative economic consequences for both sides. The problem in the short term is that because Russia is a hydrocarbon power and a tyranny, Putin can deliver money on the short term. He can say, on Tuesday, I'll give you $2 billion to do this, for example, crack down the streets of Kyiv. If you don't do it well enough, I'll take the money away. Other kinds of powers can't do that. So the way that this has to be solved in the long run is that a political process in Ukraine has to be underway where the attractions of the European Union and of the West generally can be felt on a day-to-day basis. The fundamental problem is that with Russia, you have tactics in order to make things worse, and then the Russians can say everything is bad and you saw it was always going to be like this, as opposed to very difficult, as Stephen says, very difficult, complicated processes to allow things to move forward. I don't think it's impossible. It's definitely right that the people who matter in Ukraine have their children and they have their money and they have their businesses, or at least their front businesses, in the West. And ultimately, I think this is a kind of challenge to the European Union. Is the European Union also about oligarchy, like Ukraine and Russia, or will it have the courage to freeze some of these assets, look at some of these politically exposed people, and push just a little bit back against the hypocrisy of being against the European Union while having all of your money inside banks in the European Union?
A question for the wallet. Let's bring our listeners in. Montreal, Canada. Josh is calling. Josh, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Tom, I think your American listeners should know this, that Ukraine is to Russia a very vital strategic zone. They have their most important naval port there in Sebastopol, and they're not about to give that up. It actually was a gift that during the Khrushchev era.
Now we can see that, Josh, on a map, but, and we can see it by economy. Right, but now the protesters are saying we don't want this government, and Russia's okay with it. What should happen?
Well, yes, but I just wanted, my second point was to put it in a geopolitical or historical context. If there was a revolution like the one that occurred in 1910 in Mexico, in the Mexican Revolution, where there was a corrupt president and an autocrat in power who was overthrown, what would the U.S. do? Well, what they did was they sent in the Marines to quell and stabilize the country. So to compare it, it's similar to the Mexican Revolution that occurred 100 years ago. The United States could not stand idle. They had to intervene. It was in their vital strategic interest.
Josh, we've got it. Our time is short before the break. Stephen Pfeiffer, you hear the argument. It's their backyard. It's vital to Putin's vision. They're not going to let it go. It sounds almost like an Iron Curtain thing.
I think the Russians are going to press very hard on this, but ultimately I think the Ukrainians, if they can get a process going forward, I think what the Ukrainians would like to do is say, look, we wish to draw closer to Europe. We want to draw the association agreement, but we would still have a constructive relationship with Russia. And I think Ukraine would be prepared, as it's been prepared for the last 22 years, to let the Russians continue to use the naval base at Sevastopol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it from Ukrainians, I think, see this as it shouldn't be an either-or choice. Part of the challenge, though, is the Russians have said, no, it is neither our choice. If you're going to Europe, then you're going to have a bad relationship with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the crisis in Ukraine, for Ukraine, for Russia, for the rest of the world, U.S. very much included. Timothy Snyder, a history professor at Yale University, joins us today from Vienna, Austria, knows this region very well. Stephen Pfeiffer was ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, 98 to 2000. He's at the Brookings Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative now. Director there joins us from Washington. Just today, a couple of members of the Ukrainian Olympic team have pulled out of Sochi father and daughter, father the coach, the daughter Bogdana Matsuchka, alpine skier, saying they will pull out of the Olympics and fly home. Here she is talking to the BBC.
Now our president just decided to do this really bad things to citizens of my country, and I cannot have good race in this situation.
But have you finished competing?
Tomorrow needs to be my best discipline slalom, my favorite, but I decide that I cannot do this.
The Ukrainian Olympic skier pulling out, heading home, talking with the BBC's Julian Marshall. She said she will go home and go to join the protests in the heart of Kiev. At a news conference in Paris yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. and its European allies are looking for ways to influence the situation in Ukraine.
We are talking about the possibility of sanctions or other steps with our friends in Europe and elsewhere in order to try to create the environment for compromise.
The death toll rising. Cynthia in Chicago is calling. Cynthia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I'm really glad to hear that the Ukrainian athlete has pulled out, and that was exactly my point, that I'm very, very troubled that it's such a schizophrenic situation where we're hearing that Putin has his hand and telling Ukraine to dip their hands in blood, and they're sniping people, but yet we're all over carrying on with the pomp and circumstance of the Olympics while that's going on. And I think America should pull out and of the Olympics and at least talk about it and threaten it and put it front and center. And maybe that is the push that needs to happen to settle things down there.
Cynthia, I appreciate your call. Stephen Pfeiffer, can you imagine some combination of Western efforts that would be big enough to offset Vladimir Putin's interest in having this tight relationship with Kiev undisturbed?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. Again, I think the sanctions would apply a stick that might begin to change the calculations in Kyiv among those people around Mr. Yanukovych and perhaps get him to work on the political dialogue. Then the big question comes, could the West mount a financial package that would match what Mr. Putin's put on the table?
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be hard. I think if the West came up with $15 billion, Putin would say, fine, I'll raise you another $10 billion. But what the West could do with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank is put together a serious package, although it would require that Ukraine adopt some serious and painful economic reforms. Now, one of the advantages, if there could be a genuine dialogue that might produce some kind of a national unity government, is that kind of government could take hard steps, like raising the price of energy within that are charged to households in Ukraine. It could take that and then share the political blame, share the political responsibility for those hard steps. But that requires that Mr. Yanukovych become a lot more foresighted than he's shown himself in the last couple of months. Some concessions had moved down that path because the West is not going to offer serious money unless Ukraine is prepared to make some serious economic changes. Mr. Putin basically takes $15 billion that his country's earned from the sale of oil and gas and is prepared to throw it into Ukraine, even if it's a black hole that the money will never be seen again. It was interesting that Mr. Putin took that $15 billion out of a Russian investment fund. They had to change the rules of the investment fund before they could send the money to Ukraine because Ukraine did not qualify. It did not have a high enough Moody's grade standard to qualify for the loan.
Ukraine's economy in such desperate shape that that money from Moscow, big money, brought them to Putin's side. Timothy Snyder, let's imagine. I mean, you say the West isn't going to directly intervene. Let's say they up the ante with money here. You say Vladimir Putin has many levers. Can you picture any situation in which he would fold and say, fine, Ukraine turns to the West, I'm out?
Well, the dangerous thing is that the answer is no. I mean, he
right.
can't say that I'm folding on Ukraine. He's already made claims along the lines of Ukraine is more of a territory than a state. Ukrainians and Russians are share one history and so on. It's quite clear that in order for his great dream to be achieved of Eurasian Union, Ukraine has to be involved. So he can't fold on Ukraine, at least not openly. On the other hand, he does know how to lose, or at least he knows how to lose tactically. He lost in Ukraine in 2005. He won't go away, but one can certainly imagine him finding a way out which looks honorable. And I think that is not to be excluded. On the Western side, there is actually a fair amount that we can do. I mean, he can be competed with. The one thing which hasn't been talked about enough, I think, is trade deals for individual Ukrainian goods where there are markets in the EU or even the United States. In addition to targeted sanctions, a loosening of visa regime for educated Ukrainians or for Ukrainian or certain Ukrainian businessmen who don't happen to be billionaires would also be a big step, making us more popular and allowing for the circulation of ideas. There are a lot of things that we could do in the meantime, which would help the country. So I don't think it's just a matter of having more money. It's a matter of being determined to think of ways to engage the particular industrial sectors and the particular parts of the population that over the long run are going to matter.
Boy, the clock is really ticking with this death toll, though. Peter in Boston, last call on this, Peter. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Listen, your coverage actually very much not accurate at all about Ukraine. I am from this region. And, you know, you're trying to blame Putin again. What he has to do? Nothing he has to do. First of all, the West has to do with this. West want to space. You know, West want to sell their stuff. They want to space. We see it differently completely. It's like 1941 when West attacked Russia. I'm telling you, not the German attack. Even the Hungarian, Romanian, Italian, German, Bulgarian, Finland, whatever. They are doing the same today. Exactly. We see it.
Peter, our time is so short, but we've got the point, Ambassador Pfeiffer. Peter says, don't blame Putin. This is a power grab by the West into, Russia's front yard.
Well, again, I think if you look at this in geopolitical terms, it's been a very one-sided competition. And it's pretty clear that the strength and motivation is on the Russian side. Vladimir Putin and Moscow care more about losing Ukraine than the European Union cares about gaining Ukraine. Now, that still doesn't mean that Ukraine is lost, because I still believe that this crisis is going to be resolved first and foremost by Ukrainians. And as ugly as the situation looks now, I still have hope that they can find a solution. And I think that Yanukovych, his use of force may have been a miscalculation. There may be a big public backlash against him for what's happened in the last several days.
Does he have to step down to have hope of a solution here?
That's what the demonstrators demand. I think it would be good to find a way not to corner him, because if he's cornered, he may not be prepared to do the dialogue.
Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, now director of the Brookings Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative, joining us from Washington. Ambassador Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, joining us from Vienna. Timothy Snyder, thank you very much for your insights today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, we'll look at the continuing anti-government protests in Venezuela. This is On Point. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro is facing the largest anti-government protest in his 11 months in power. Major social and economic problems sparked a wave of protests which began just over 2 weeks ago. 5 people have been killed, and opposition leader Leopoldo López is now behind bars, accused of inciting violence. Joining me now from Caracas in Venezuela is Irena Caselli, the BBC's correspondent in Venezuela. Irena, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Are people still in the streets today?
They are indeed. Let me just clarify that the situation is very hard to read at this point. There have been ongoing protests, as you were saying, but there's a sort of media blackout. It's very hard to get a sense of what's happening outside of the capital city, Caracas, which is where I am at the moment. We're hearing that there's many protests, especially in the western city of San Cristobal, very close to the border with Colombia. I I was hearing from a colleague yesterday on Wednesday that she thought that the situation in San Cristobal was very similar to a warlike zone and much tougher, with barricades and open sort of battles between pro-opposition and anti and pro-government supporters. So at this very point, it's hard to tell whether there are only only five people died, and it's very hard to give a proper picture of what's happening around the entire country.
Irina, under President Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's politics became very class-oriented. Chavez, of course, pushed that analysis of what was going on. Describe for us, if you can, the political forces now or social class forces at work in these protests, this conflict in Venezuela today.
Yes, we can tell that we can definitely say that the protests are very much middle class protests. Their concerns are very much middle class concerns. So protesters, students first went out to the streets to complain against the insecurity situation, but also about the economy. The economic situation here in Venezuela is very tough at the moment. There's one of the highest inflation rates in the world. 2013 ended with an inflation rate of 56%, and there are shortages of basic food staples such as milk or sugar, and even toilet paper is hard to find. Now, however, the people that are in the streets are not starving. They're not directly affected by the economic situation, but they are students that are worried about what their future will look like. At the same time, the government remains very popular. Let's not forget that President Maduro won just 11 months ago by a narrow majority, but then the government party actually won by a wider margin during local elections in December. So the government remains very popular, especially among lower classes. The lower classes in Venezuela have achieved more, have become better off under Hugo Chavez. For example, there were very high indexes of undernourishment. And that right now the UN says that actually Venezuelans are not undernourished anymore. So it is definitely about classes, about different classes. And so far, the protest remains very much a middle class protest.
Is it clear where a middle ground might be? Are the two sides interested in some kind of steps that might mean a compromise that would address the middle class concerns without abandoning the lower class that Chavez threw in with?
It seems very unlikely right now. On Wednesday night, the president, Nicolas Maduro, was on national TV during a broadcast, and he actually said that the streets belong to the people and not to the fascists. He tends to refer to the opposition and to the protesters as fascists. So it seems that he's using very incendiary words, and on the opposition side, the discourse is very similar as well. They call the president a puppet of Mr. Castro in Cuba. So right now, there doesn't seem to be that middle ground you're talking about, and that's probably the most worrying thing about the current situation.
And the status of this opposition leader who's come into the limelight, Leopoldo Lopez, Harvard-educated, now we're told in government custody, what does he represent, and where do you see his role possibly going as we look ahead?
Well, he's definitely a hardliner within the opposition. The opposition leader until recently was Enrique Capriles. He's the one who ran against Mr. Chavez in 2012 and then again against Mr. Maduro in 2013. But Enrique Capriles seems to be more of a moderate. Leopoldo López really used the sort of desperation of people in the streets, and he called for more protests, which is something that actually Mr. Capriles was against. So we can say he's now emerging as a new figure within the opposition, He's a sort of a political maverick, really. He goes outside party lines, and he's probably even thinking very much about his political career. Let's not forget that Hugo Chavez himself and Enrique Capriles, they were both in jail, and they got quite a lot of popularity during their period in prison. So maybe this is also a smart political move for him.
Do you sense a possibility of a real turn in the political winds in Venezuela, or does this likely end with the Chavez successor, President Maduro, still in power and without a major reorientation?
It seems very unlikely at this point that any change will take place at a government level. Mr. Maduro remains very popular. The opposition is a large minority, but it remains a minority. Many people will say that the country is split exactly 50-50, but the latest elections, local elections in December, didn't show that. They showed a wider majority was in favor of the government. And although the economic situation is tough, it's tougher on a longer term basis. On a daily basis here, nobody's starving. There isn't any sort of obvious situation from which stronger protests may emerge.
Reina Caselli with the BBC in Caracas, of course, saying that her field of vision right now and many others is more or less limited to Caracas. A lot going on around Venezuela. Even as we speak, we'll no doubt learn more about that in the days ahead. Reina Caselli of the BBC in Venezuela, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Emily Alfin Johnson, Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Claire Lancaster, Hillary McQuilkin, and Sarah Platt, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.